On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we discuss the latest renderings of the A's ballpark scheduled to open in Las Vegas in 2028, talk about the extension that they agreed to with outfielder Lawrence Butler, and then a special guest, Carson Lund, the director of the film Ephes, a baseball film that we quite enjoyed that is coming out this weekend. And then, of course, it is Friday, so we're going to give you the good, the bad, and the ugly on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that might have changed the design of a baseball stadium? Question mark. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And if you believe in the Las Vegas athletic renderings, then boy, oh boy, this podcast might have a little more juice than we thought.
It was about a year ago, my dear friend Jake, that we talked about the first elaborate renderings of the hypothetical Las Vegas A's ballpark scheduled to hypothetically open in 2028. And as you mentioned, it seems like they took some of our advice. That will be one of our first topics today as we go A's heavy on the front end of this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast, talking about something that they absolutely have accomplished. This ballpark's a long way away, but they have managed to extend one of their best players, Lawrence Butler, to a long-term deal. We're going to talk about that. We have a special guest. It's Carson Lund, who directed the film Ephes, which we were fortunate enough to get an early screening on. We don't like baseball movies that much. This was a baseball movie we both quite enjoyed, and we're going to talk to the director about it. So very much looking forward to that. And then, of course, it is Friday, so we have some more news, and then the good, the bad, the ugly. But Jake, let us begin with the opener. Lawrence Butler has agreed to a 7-year extension with the A's worth $65.5 million, according to ESPN's Jeff Passan. This was a deal that was reportedly in the works over the last few weeks. This is something that, as we know, the A's have been trying to exhibit a long-term commitment to not only the roster in a way that they previously were not, but also to some of their core players. Of course, they agreed to an extension with Brent Rooker. But I think that this deal with Lawrence Butler is an even bigger deal for a lot of reasons. But before we get to the financials and kind of the bigger picture things for what this means for the franchise, I think we should talk about Lawrence Butler, the player, because I think even after his awesome second half last year, this is still a player that not enough people are super familiar with.
Okay, so Lawrence Butler is 24 years old. This will be his age 24 season. He was a sixth round pick by the A's out of a high school in the Atlanta area. And the profile was basically, boy, he strikes out a lot, but if he ever learns to not do that, he could be pretty freaking awesome because the in-box power here is legit. And he debuted in 2023 and looked pretty dreadful in a small stint in the big leagues and struggled for the front end of last season before catching absolute fuego in the second half of the year, finishing basically like top 10 in baseball in most meaningful, all-encompassing offensive categories behind the all-stars and MVP guys, and finished the year with an OPS adjusted 30% above league average. He's really, really good, and is the person in the A's organization most likely to win an MVP or finish top three in an MVP in the next 5 to 10 years.
I think that comparing him to Rooker for a few reasons is important, both in terms of them as players, where they are in their careers, and also where they fit into the larger story of the A's. Because when they extend Brent Rooker, and Brent Rooker's awesome and he deserved that money, and we talked about how that deal made sense for the player and made sense for the team because he's a DH. And while you could say, oh wow, like that's still not that much for a guy who's one of the best hitters in baseball, like he's a DH in his 30s who's not going to offer any defensive value and maybe just had his best season. Whereas Lawrence Butler, this is a deal right now. Well, even though it's really only been, you know, 70, 80 games of high level performance, he is still 24 years old, is going to be offering more value across the board, whether it's speed, whether it's defense, and his best years are almost certainly still in front of them, in front of him. This is a player that you really do want to be able to build around in a very real way, that I can imagine if the A's do open a ballpark in Vegas in 2028, that he is, you know, batting second or third. Like, that is a thing that is way more believable. As good as Brent Rooker is right now, it's harder to know what exactly he's going to be in 3-4 years, whereas Lawrence Butler is trending in a way where he's looking like he could be a true all-star player to build around.
But on the flip side, there's way more volatility.
Sure.
And way more risk involved with the Butler deal. And that's just because of the floor and this compared to Rooker. Right, like, it's hard to imagine Rooker being a bad player in the next 4 seasons. It's difficult to imagine him winning an MVP. Butler is 5 months removed from not being relevant to of not being impactful, of not having delivered meaningful production at the big league level, to the point that in the stadium rendering a year ago, he was not included in the projected lineup. Okay.
Well,
and so a lot has happened.
Yes.
A lot has happened here for this player in a short amount of time, but the gamble for the A's is undeniably worth the upside.
Yes. Yes. But the other thing that I want to get at with Butler, as we zoom out as to what this means and why it is important to invest in a player like him also, is Brent Rooker. Now, credit to the, you know, A's front office for identifying, like, oh, this is someone we should claim on waivers or however they got him. And then, realistically, Brent Rooker fell in their lap and he blossomed there because it was a good place for it, right? So that's awesome. And I'm glad it worked out for them. Lawrence Butler is homegrown. Lawrence Butler was drafted in 2018. Lawrence Butler is one of the longest tenured members of this organization. And the other amazing thing about Lawrence Butler, you mentioned sixth round, the A's 2018 draft is one of the more astonishing groups of players in retrospect that you can really have in a draft. And why is that? Well, okay, so Lawrence Butler was a sixth round pick. Okay, wow, it's a pretty good sixth round pick, right? Oh, well, I wonder, you think, oh man, well, they got Lawrence Butler that year. Who, if they got Lawrence Butler in the sixth, who else did they get that year? Well, their first round pick was Kyler Murray. And that did obviously not go the way that they were hoping, as Kyler Murray is still playing football and has not been a part of their team whatsoever. Neither were their second and third picks that year. Jameson Hanna and Jeremy Ironman, who were college players, never made the big leagues. Those were high picks in the top 70 picks, never made the big leagues. Hogan Harris was their third round pick. That's a guy who has become a useful pitcher for them. The guy who started the reverse boycott game in 2023 and pitched like the game of his life and became kind of this weird cult hero in the organization. He's still part of the team. He's also one of the longer tenured members of this organization. But then you just got some other names dotted in here, like Max Schumann, their 20th rounder. He's still around. Jonah Bride was a 23rd rounder who's now with the Marlins. Like, the fact that this draft started with Kyler Murray, produced Lawrence Butler, and also had a couple other players along the way, when you consider that draft could have been, if Lawrence Butler doesn't become what he's been, one of the biggest disastrous drafts that we have, right? I mean, if Lawrence Butler doesn't exist, the opportunity cost of having taken Kyler Murray ahead of many good major leaguers is one of the more embarrassing sequences that the A's could have had. And it's also funny because it's like, you draft Kyler Murray because he's this athlete that you want to become an awesome baseball player. That's also why you draft Lawrence Butler, and he turned out to be an awesome baseball player. Now, it took a long time, right? I mean, 2018 was a long time ago. It took him a while in the minors. But I just love how that all turned out, because remembering that they took Kyler Murray 9th overall and how badly that worked out, and now that they got Lawrence Butler out of the same draft, I just think that that's great.
Last point on Butler, just as a player. I mean, we talk a lot about ensuring that there are baseball opportunities for all different types of people, and how the demographics of our game have gotten significantly less black over the last 25 years. Butler and his story is a really good example of how to make the game available and accessible for somebody who might otherwise not be exposed to it. Like, yes, he's from Atlanta, where there's a very rich baseball history that's around, and he's not from like Maine or Canada, where it's cold and there's no fields, right? But he played in the Atlanta RBI program, reviving baseball in inner cities. He went to a high school that was 93% black, and came up in a league called, I believe it's the Marquise Grissom Baseball Association, which was a league that former big leaguer Marquise Grissom started in Atlanta. He was in that league with Michael Harris. Like, this is the pathway. Like, this is how it works in a good way. And, you know, for me, as someone who coaches Little League Baseball in Harlem and thinks about this stuff like all the freaking time, to see a guy like that get a deal like this is so freaking cool. It's so cool. And like, it's one guy, but it is in some ways like a template, right? Of how the, like, I don't want to toot MLB's horn here.
Sure.
Because it was a problem of their own making in some ways. But a lot of the programs that they have put money into are doing good stuff. And I think Butler's a good example of that.
And I think, too, we've talked about this with other players that have kind of broken out, not necessarily late in their career. It's not like he's older, but it was a slow burn as a prospect. And a lot of that is the timing.
Yeah.
You draft athletes because you hope that they put it together and they figure it all out. And that happened with him in the big leagues last year. But this is a guy that after he signed in, 2018, was not good in rookie ball, was not good in short season ball in 2019. And then 2020, he doesn't even get to play minor league baseball because it's all canceled because of the pandemic. So at that point, going into 2021, Lawrence Butler is not someone that you're realistically going to have optimism about, because you're looking at him, you're like, well, this guy's got like a 600 career OPS and he just missed a whole year of development. Like, this probably isn't going to work out. 2021, he really breaks out, and that begins kind of the slow climb to the big leagues, where he starts making these adjustments and applying the physical skills to actual production. And that's what makes it so cool, because now he still is, because this is why you draft high schoolers. You have more time for them to figure it out. And now he breaks out and is one of the best players in the American League, and he's still only 24.
MLB Network did a cool little Black History Month roundtable with Lawrence Butler, Michael Harris Jr., and friend of the program, Taylor Trammell. Mm-hmm. And in that roundtable, great quote from Lawrence Butler: I got a reminder set every day for 1 o'clock on my phone, All-Star Game 2025, Atlanta, Georgia, right? And I just keep an eye on that. And if he makes it for the A's, it'll be very, very, very
That is a great point. All right. So that is honestly a good transition to just the bigger picture with the A's and the other bit of news that we got, which is that, well, two bits of news. One is real news, which is that they hired a new president. Dave Cavill moved on, for better, probably for better or for worse. I guess, yes.
He skedaddled.
Skedaddled, right. So Dave Cavill, after a fairly shameful tenure where he made a lot of people, insulted a lot of people and whatever. Anyway, he's not the president anymore. So, okay, so who are you going to hire as president? Well, what are they trying to accomplish right now as a franchise? Move to Las Vegas. And so who has recently taken someone from Las Vegas or from Oakland and moved them to Las Vegas and built a new stadium? This gentleman, Mark Badane, who is their new president, who was the president for the Raiders when they moved to Las Vegas and built a new stadium. So they're like, huh, who has experience doing that? This dude, who I think recently resigned as the president of the Raiders and is now going to be the president of the A's. So we're still in the early stages of really learning how Mark Badane handles speaking publicly in a tactful way. Obviously, none of the ways that he's going to do this is going to make the good people of Oakland feel any better. So I recognize that. But obviously, there is a level of PR that was not being accomplished with Dave Cavill that maybe in some ways will be by Mark Badane. But anyway, with that announcement also came an update regarding their stadium in Las Vegas, which fortunately for us who do a baseball podcast means we get more fun pictures to laugh at and give hyper detailed comments on. Jake, as you mentioned earlier, this is something we did almost exactly a year ago when the A's released early renderings of their stadium, which is supposed to begin construction this summer and open for the 2028 season. And it does appear that if you go back and listen or watch our podcast episode from March 6th a year ago, you will hear us laugh at a lot of things regarding the renderings. And again, you can see these on the A's social media accounts, although again, don't expect to be able to reply to them because those replies are still off. But it seems that they took some of our notes and applied them. Now, I'm sure we weren't the only ones pointing these out, but there are multiple parts of this rendering that they have changed that seem to directly reflect complaints that we had. Now, there are also some things that have not been changed that I'm still laughing at, and we can talk about those too. But where would you like to begin?
I went back and listened to that podcast we did and just took some notes on the things we critiqued them on. Here's what they changed. There was no netting behind home plate before, which is hilarious because every foul ball is a murder.
Yeah, seems bad
in that case. Can't have that. Netting netting has been added. Congratulations.
We love that. We love
to
that.
The fans. There were no dugout railings before.
Here's the funny thing about the dugout railings, though, which I don't think we mentioned last time, is that you know who also didn't have dugout railings?
The old days.
So now those were much farther. Those are much farther away. So I think that was why we saw this. We're like, whoa, that looks really dangerous because, you know, okay, maybe you add the netting, but let's get some dugout railings for people there. And they did see they added those.
Bullpens. There were no bullpens before. They added bullpens because bullpens are important to the baseball match. So now they have them.
Or maybe by 2028, Manfred has, in an effort,
no relievers.
No relievers. It's just starters got to go all nine.
You warm up on the mound, buddy. Right. There was only one umpire last time.
Yes.
On the
yes.
field.
Well, I do want to talk about the umpires, but it's true that there was only one of them. And this time there are four. That's true.
And it's great. God, I love this.
Okay.
It makes me so
okay.
Mad.
So I want to, let's put the scoreboard to the side. Although one note about the scoreboard, last year, the scoreboard was
One more. Yeah. There are lights. There were no lights in the stadium before.
Now there are lights.
They added lights.
Oh, that's a great point. Okay. I don't even remember that. So one thing about the scoreboard, and we're going to talk about the names on the scoreboard in a second. Last time it was kind of like almost projected onto the roof. And we were like, what is this? Like, is this like a sphere style? Like, you know, very Vegas. But now the updated one, it actually looks like a scoreboard that's kind of connected to the roof. It looks like a separate, like now it looks like something that I've seen before. Whereas before I was like, I don't know if that's going to work.
It looks like Houston or Seattle's enormous scoreboard.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. We'll finish with the names on the scoreboard because that's obviously the fun stroke. I want to get back to the umps. What was the other funniest part of the umps last time that appears to still be the case this year?
They were wearing baseball pants.
So, obviously, as we critiqued last time, there are most of the elements of this seem to be some level of AI generated, which means that, you know, it seems to know, like, all right, well, we have to have umpires wearing black, different uniforms than the players. But it does appear that these umps not only are still wearing baseball pants, they're also seem to all be wearing like batting gloves. Like they're wearing like short sleeves, but then they all seem to be wearing gloves. And it looks like they're also wearing like high socks with with cleats.
It's great.
The umpire uniforms remain a little bit questionable. Do you have any other thoughts about the other people on the field? Last year we had some questions about whether there were base coaches. It seems like they did add base coaches here in addition to the two runners on base for the A's.
Well, they added base coaches. However, it seems that the first base coach is wearing the visiting team's uniform. So that's funny. That's a good rule change.
Yeah, that one is probably not what they meant. So that one is pretty goofy. But other than that, again, I do like that we got four umps, which is definitely an upgrade. This is not a D3 baseball game where you got one or two, maybe if you're lucky. And again, the bullpen's got it getting added. We like that. The left field wall in the renderings last year seemed to be just completely translucent. And we were like, is there even a fence here? Like, what's the situation? Now it seems to be a little bit more defined, which is nice. And so, yeah, I do think that they, like, again, they took a lot of notes and I think that they applied a lot of
them. Whoever did this second rendering has watched a baseball game before. And that did not seem to be necessarily true with the last rendering. One bizarro thing, though, I would like to point out is the dugouts seem to have a divider in them that disconnects the far end from the near end with like a weird wall.
Oh, you're right.
And I don't know what that's about at all. It's very unnecessary.
Very strange. That's like a mechitza.
Also, it's like a mechitza. Exactly. It also looks like the Yankees, the visiting team, are wearing jeans in the dugout.
Yes, I did notice that. You can Google mechitza if you don't know what that means. I think that now we should talk. The last topic before we take a break and send it to our guest is, let's talk about the scoreboard.
I have one more before that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Last time, there were no like jerseys with players' names on them in the crowd. That has been changed.
There were a couple, but not as many. Yeah.
There were no A's player nameplates in the crowd.
Oh,
there
no,
were
you're
A's
right. You're
jerseys,
right.
But yeah, there were no right. nameplates in the crowd. That is no longer the case. Congratulations to Brent Rooker and J.J. Bleday, yeah. who had good enough seasons last year
yes.
to be included in the AI so,
yes.
jerseys.
Let's talk about that. Okay, so the real fun we had last year was looking at the hypothetical A's lineup that they presented to us on this big on the big screen, the scoreboard. We made the note last year that like they didn't have to do this. They could have just had a screen that said, you know, welcome to Las Vegas. They didn't. This was a choice to be like, let's make this feel real. Let's make it feel like these players on the A's are going to be playing in Las Vegas. And we fairly pointed out, like, before we even get to all the batting averages here, like how many of these players are actually going to play in Vegas? Last year, they highlighted Zach Geloff as like their guy. He was the big picture on the scoreboard. He was batting second. And coming off of 2023, that made some sense. It was like, all right, Zach Geloff, he's going to be the guy. That seems to have cursed Zach Geloff as he had a atrocious season in 2024, although he has managed to remain on the lineup. One of only three players from last year's lineup of nine to make it all the way to the next rendering, which makes me wonder, alongside Brent Rooker and Shea Langeliers, which makes me wonder, when we get the new ones in a year from now, who? This is a big year for Zach Geloff to stay on the board yeah. a year from now. I think that's a good way to think about it.
Here's a funny one. Mm-hmm. There are runners on first and second in this graphic, yep. right? Yep. Nobody out. Two runs already yep. in. Rooker is up.
Oh, yes, two runs okay. already in. Yep.
Rooker is up. Mm-hmm. There's a runner on first. Mm-hmm. The Rooker is hitting second. The person hitting first above Rooker is Butler, is Lawrence Butler.
Yep.
So the runner on first has to be Lawrence Butler, correct?
No. Yes. No.
Yes.
No.
How? There are no outs.
Oh, there's no outs. okay. yeah. Okay. Yes. Okay. Yep. Good point.
Guy on first is a white dude. So
yeah, now we're really digging. Now you know what? I'm gonna throw a flag on this one because
what?
now you're asking for way too much from them. but I do agree. Again, but this is what you get. The more details that you try to put into it, you leave yourself open for very reasonable criticism from my good friend Jake Mintz. Other yeah. things about the lineup. Now they're playing the Yankees. They're already up 9-0 in the. In the third inning, who started this game for the Yankees in 2028? That in a team that also somehow still has Giancarlo Stanton and Paul Goldschmidt in 2028.
Free agent Nestor Cortez, who they
re-signed. He's back. Okay, yeah, got it. Nice. That makes sense. But yeah, I mean, you know, some of the other guys in this lineup, like I still think, you know, I mentioned last year, I think we should still be future casting. I think we should be putting in names that we hope are in the A's lineup in 2028, future free agents, future high-end draft picks. I mentioned last year Nick Kurtz, and they did draft him 3 months later, absolutely nailed that one. Might as well just throw out some other names that they could draft this year. I know they're not drafting as high, but I don't know. I just feel like Miguel Andujar, I'm sorry, he's not going to be on the Vegas A's. It's not going to happen.
Gio Urshela on a one-year contract like that.
Gio Urshela might not be on the team in July. I mean, why are we talking about him on the team in 2028?
Anyway,
happy for Brent Rooker, who's still batting 303, by the way.
Yeah, that's great. Brent Rooker batting 303. I am fascinated how they chose these various batting averages. Like, Shea Langeliers, I believe, is hitting 1 point lower than he was the year before.
Yeah.
Like, he just ticked one off of his batting average. Like,
right, what? Which like, is like, made weird. That decision? Like, but also like Brent Rooker, we all laughed when it had him hitting 303 last year, and then he had an amazing season. Also, Shea Langeliers, who hit 205 in 2023, hit 224 in 2024, which means he improved, but I guess they realized like, batting average probably not going to be his thing.
At that rate, he'll get to 285 by 2028. Last point, and then we'll
good
take
point.
A break. This Yankees lineup, there's been a lot of discussion about the optimal Yankees lineup. Okay.
Right.
And I'm going to go to the Yankees today and I'm going to ask Aaron Boone, hey man, is this how you draw it up?
So the Yankees lineup again, 2028, Chisholm, Bellinger, Judge, Stanton, Wells, Goldschmidt, Volpe, Dominguez, Cabrera. So I like that they at least know like DJ LeMahieu's not part of this, but Stanton still is. Stanton, who is currently very injured and will not be playing baseball anytime soon. He's still in there. Now, I think his contract is done by then, right? Isn't 2027 his last year?
Yes, yeah. Goldschmidt will be 50, but he's included. I like that DJ LeMahieu's not in here. It brings up, because he was going to be the opening day third baseman if he hadn't gotten hurt, right? Yes. Did they make this edit like in the interim between the DJ LeMahieu calf tweak and
no? But the Stanton injury happened before the LeMahieu one.
Yeah, so but he's got so much more juice. It's like, well, Stanton's got to be in there.
Yeah, Volpe's still batting seventh in 2028. It's probably a bit of a disappointment.
This is really not how I would do the lineup. To have the two lefties, Chisholm and Bellinger, 1-2, and then Judge, Stanton, the two righties, 3-4. Whoever put that together.
Who do you want leading off? Yeah, Judge's got to be batting second. I mean, that's the obvious thing.
Yeah, I would probably go Judge. I would go Chisholm, Judge, Bellinger, Stanton.
Yeah. Anyway, we love this. I hope we have another one of these in a year. This just brings me so much joy. So thank you, A's, for giving us stuff to talk about. We are going to take a quick break. And when we return, we will be joined by the director of the film EPHIS, Carson Lund. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast, Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. If you've listened to this show for a while, you know that while Jordan and I love baseball, we do not like baseball movies. It took me 5 years to watch Moneyball after it came out. I have never seen Bull Durham or The Natural, which is maybe a disqualifying fact about me. And yet, Jordan, when we received information about the movie EPHIS, which we talked about on the podcast, I believe like a month ago when we saw the trailer, we were hooked. We were fascinated. We were intrigued. And then we saw it and we fell in love. And on this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we are honored to be joined by Carson Lund. You are like 85 things on this movie, so I'm just going to call you the brainchild of the film. Carson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It feels weird to say brainchild because there's so many other brainchildren on the film, but I appreciate it either way.
So Carson, why did you make this movie, EPHIS, and what is it? And because there are so many, it is such a simple and charming film that Jake and I both adored in ways that, not that obviously we were excited to watch it once we saw the trailer, but like we said, there's baseball movies where we have high standards for them and we don't usually enjoy the representation of baseball, whatever. This was so pure and so enjoyable. Why did you make this film? Why were you motivated to make this film?
I'm right there with you. I haven't enjoyed many baseball films. I haven't seen any baseball films in a long time just because I watched them when I was a kid and I got the same sense of, you know, artifice that you guys felt, or something felt phony, you know, and baseball is usually used as like a kind of like a vehicle for something else. I really wanted to make a movie that actually captures the feeling of playing baseball, because I've played myself for many years and I've joined a rec league in Los Angeles in the last decade, and over the years have really grown close with my teammates, and I felt that the kind of camaraderie that we developed on the field was a very special, unique kind of male bonding that only happens once a week, you know, within the confines of a baseball field, and then you all go home. And so you share this closeness, but it's also only within a very, very specific context. And I felt like that hadn't been explored in a narrative feature before, to my mind, to my knowledge. And I thought that giving it the flow and weird poetry and rhythm of baseball would give it a special kind of funkiness.
And there are these moments in the
Go ahead.
There are these moments in the film where when I was watching, I was like, that shot is 10 seconds too long. And then I would be like, oh, right. Like, it's baseball. Like, it's supposed to be, right? Like, that's the whole point of it all. When people ask you, what is this movie about? What do you say?
Man, it's about a lot of things, but at the core of it, I think it's about change and having to cope with change. and being people being, you know, to sound like a academic for a second, like being bodies in space, essentially, like we are humans and we have to endure time's passage and we have to deal with that. We get older, things change around us and we have to go through all of these different uncomfortable growing pains. And we have to say goodbye to a lot of things as that happens. So with this film, what I really want to do is make the viewer feel vicariously the experience of the players, you know, that they are going through this passage of life that's upsetting for them, but it's the only way they know each other. It's the only way they know how to relate and is right there on the baseball field. And it means so much to them, even though it means so little to the outside world. And I want you to feel very present when you're watching it. I want you to feel that time passing because that is baseball. As baseball fans, I think we can all recognize that the downtime of a game is just as important as any of the home runs or the double plays.
100%. And again, for those who we encourage, obviously we'll be telling everybody to go watch this film, but the basic, in terms of just setting up the story, it is two, you know, rec league, men's league teams who are playing at this field and have been playing there for years. And the field is going to be, they're constructing a school on the field, so they will no longer be able to play at this field. And so what we are seeing is kind of the end of this experience playing on this field. I think what Jake and I related to so much, and Jake in particular, because he, you know, spent multiple summers playing for teams sort of like this. There were some very close similarities. There are certainly some differences in terms of the ages of the players that he was playing. And by the way, even I got to play in a couple of these games, which is exactly how you know that anyone can play, which is part of the fun. But I think that what I am so compelled by when you're saying you want to feel what it's like to be hanging on and appreciating what it means to just like still be doing something that means so much in this specific instance. What's so funny, and some of the comedy of this for sure, and why the writing is so great, and is also something that we've experienced up close, Jake, is that what's so unique about it is that, okay, so it means so much to them, and yet so many of them like seem actively to hate it while also like loving it so much. Like the amount of like disgruntledness while also like unable to let go is such a beautiful balance that I think you depict so perfectly and objectively hilariously. I mean, that's part of the comedy of it too, but it's also what's part of so real. Jake, I know you've felt it personally, but it's also something you see, you just see in the people's faces. And if you've seen it up close, it's very specific.
It's, and Carson, I'll let you hop in here on this. Like, it's the way that they cuss. It is this disdain that they care embedded within the frustration of a strikeout. And it's those two things layered on top of each other. Just like the tone of an F-bomb it has all of that wrapped up into it, right?
Yeah, that's a really great point. Yeah, I mean, there's something about being an obsessive about something that also encourages this like disdain that you're talking about. I think I've been relating it for the past couple days because I've been here in New York talking to a lot of cinephiles. I've been relating it to kind of cinephilia, people who are crazy about movies, but also often admit they hate movies or they don't like anything that's coming out. You know, and there's a similarity between these two obsessives in that it's all about like finding the nuances that other people don't see in the thing that they love. And because other people don't see that, they have to be bitter about it. You know, baseball and loving film, it's also rooted in all these like categorizations and stat keeping and big pronunciations about very particular things. And they're also, you know, time-based activities. You know, baseball is a game that can go on forever in theory until, of course, the introduction of the pitch clock. But yeah, it creates its own sense of time, and so can a movie. But yeah, I know that sort of like, yeah, the bitterness that you're talking about, and we worked really hard on those F-bombs, you know, like it was all about finding the right tone. And this is also the movie's steeped in New England masculinity, which maybe we should specify that I'm from New England and I grew up around a certain kind of competitive banter that kind of stems from this inability to express anything other than like antipathy and anger towards your fellow man. But I think over the years, as you, that stuff kind of like hardens to the point of where it loses the bite, and it actually becomes an expression of like affection for each other. but still you're speaking in these put downs and trash talk. And I think I wanted to explore that weird tension where you're still saying something mean to someone else, but it means something different than it used to.
I want to ask about the character. I can't remember his name, and you can specify the name. There's a men's league baseball game going on, and there is one character who is there the entire time who's not playing the game, who is there solely to keep the book. What is the character's name, just so I have it in my head?
Franny.
Okay.
Yeah.
Franny, to me, is the beauty of this movie, because Franny is an outcast. Franny is someone who is going to men's league baseball games for years, not participating in them and keeping book. And the movie starts and ends with Franny. What was the inspiration for that character, and what do you think that Franny represents?
Yeah, so Franny is, there's a very direct inspiration, although the character is quite different than the reality. But there was a guy in my hometown in Nashua, New Hampshire, named Franny. And he would go to all the baseball games, whether they were the Little League games, the high school games, or the semi-professional league. It was called the Atlantic League, where the Nashua Pride used to play. It's actually at Holman Stadium, where minor league baseball first integrated, actually. So he was this guy in town who just would, everyone knew his name. He walked down up and down Main Street into businesses, shook everyone's hand. He's just like the true definition of a townie.
Yeah.
He wasn't really all there as a person, and everyone kind of knew that, but everyone sort of treated him very kindly. He would make a lot of jokes and smack people on the back, and he's like a real folk legend, I think, in my hometown. And I wrote this with my friend Mike Basta, as well as Nate Fisher, but Mike Basta is from my hometown as well. And we remembered this guy, Franny, very, very closely. And also there's an actor in the film, Pete Mancara, who remembered Franny very closely. So I wanted to pay homage to this guy who was like the spirit of our hometown. And then, you know, he was just a character in the script. And of course, Cliff Blake, who plays him, brought him to life in such a beautiful way. But then it was actually in the edit section. When we were editing the film, I got a notification on Facebook from some like hometown Facebook group that Franny had actually passed away. He had been suffering from COVID complications. He'd been in the hospital for quite a while. And I never really knew the man. I hadn't seen him in years. You know, besides like those little interactions on the baseball field or in the dugout. And it suddenly came rushing back, all these memories. And I felt like in that moment when I realized he passed away, we put a dedication on the film, but we also kind of like structured the film more around Franny. It was this kind of like eureka moment. And we started to build these chapter cards around Franny's quotes. And we bookended the film with Franny coming out of the woods and going back in. He has the Lou Gehrig quote that is also a really key part of the film. So yeah, for me, he's just he's like the only guy on this field that really kind of registers the gravity of what's happening. I think he actually does appreciate that he's been a witness to it, and all these score sheets that he's kept over the years become this like really great like library of his experience, and they have a lot of meaning for him. So, you know, I think he's a character to look up to aspire to, unlike many of the others.
Yeah, that is a good contrast in that sense, and I love how that came together, because I think it tied the whole film together so well. I think the last thing that we have to ask about, there's so many directions we could go, but before we get you out of here and you tell people where to go watch the movie, is let's talk about the most famous person in the cast and also the name of the film, which is Ephus. Mm-hmm. So tell us about why is the film called Ephus without giving stuff away, and then how does Spaceman Lee get involved in this thing?
Well, yeah, Ephus was a pitch thrown quite a bit by Bill Lee. He got a home run hit off him in the 1975 World Series, which continued the Bambino curse when he played for the Red Sox. It's a very slow hierarching pitch. I'm sure your listeners know about it. It is sort of an endangered pitch in the modern game. Zach Greinke is one of the few who still throws it. It's usually, you know, a position player comes in to mop up some innings at the end of the game, and he'll throw one. But it's just like a nothing pitch. It actually derives from Hebrew, EFES, mm-hmm. which means
FS.
Oh, FS. We know. We learned that word in Jewish day school in kindergarten.
Yeah, so it's just it's also a funny sounding word, and we were making a comedy, so it felt right. But but beyond that, I mean, I think as the character who describes the EFIS in the film will say, you know, it's a film, it's a pitch that kind of stops time or reorients the batter's sense of time because it's so much lower than the other pitches. And I think, you know, the film is trying to do that as well, to kind of like, you know, make you more aware of time passing, slow you down so you're more alert to the kind of like mundane parts of baseball that you know typically write off as boring. You know, I think a lot of there's always that part of our culture that says, oh, baseball's boring, you know. But I think our world is too fast and we could learn something from baseball. So that's why it's called EFIS. And Bill Lee, yeah, I mean he's a legend, as you know. All I had to do to get in touch with him was to call his landline in the Northeast Kingdom in Vermont. He lives right near the border of Canada, and it's the only way to get in touch with him. He has an email, but he apparently only checks it once a week when he goes to the library. So, like, we spoke on the phone for months and months leading up to the film. And yeah, he's really great. I mean, he's just such a performer.
Oh, and the way you use him is great because it doesn't linger on him. Like, and this is something I kind of want to leave people with. There are these choices made in the film that you almost tease a cliche and you make us think it's coming, and then it doesn't. And Bill Lee showing up and then just disappearing as one. And then I'll reveal this moment in the movie. So it gets dark, right? The night comes, and it is foreshadowed that there are fireworks at this field. And when this is happening, I, as someone who has seen The Sandlot, I'm like, God dang it. Like, he's gonna try and play under the fireworks. Like, oh, I hate it. It's like, and then it doesn't happen. And it's like, it is so freaking awesome that it doesn't happen. Because this movie and it is for the ball knowers and appreciators, and like, it so perfectly encapsulates like what baseball is and what it's about and why we love it and why we can't explain why we love it at the same time. And so I don't really have a question here. I just really just thanks for making it. It rules. And like, I think everyone should go see it if they are able to. Jordan, do you have any final?
No, questions? I think, yeah. Tell us, I know this is timely. So tell us how people can watch the film and, any other big picture things that you would like to communicate to someone who's, you know, going to watch this movie.
Well, I think Linda Belinda over here just nailed it with that. With that quote, he just said it. I mean, yeah. I really appreciate that. Thank you. But right now, the film is opening in New York City. Today's March 7th for the listeners, and it's coming out today. And it's really surreal to finally kind of reach this point after a year of touring the film around the world. And then it expands next week to LA and Boston, and then Chicago the week after. But throughout that process, basically throughout the month of March, it's coming to many different smaller cities around the country. And hopefully it'll be on streaming at some point. But really, we hope you see it in theaters, because I think I know it's a cliche, but I think it is a big screen movie. And that has as much to do with the CinemaScope framing as it does with the sound mix that we made, which is really attempting to put you right there on the field with all these voices all around you. So go see it.
Well, yeah. Yeah, and I'm jealous because I know Jake got to see it in the theater and I didn't, but I can imagine too that would enhance the experience so much more because it is so visceral and there are so many audio cues that just like put you on that field in a very real and kind of chilling way and in a good way. But it is pretty compelling. So Carson, this is a hell of an achievement, and we don't know anything about movies, so we are hardly experts. That should be
there. Jordan,
our opinion doesn't really mean much. But
how many of the Oscar best film nominees did you watch this year?
Me, one. I assume Carson saw more than that.
not that many. You know, I don't watch a lot of Oscar movies or care much about the Oscars, but when they, yeah. when the, if they, if they at some point nominate Ephus or something, maybe I'll change my team.
Now we can start, we can start paying attention.
Do you roll up in a Bill Spaceman Lee jersey tucked in a tuxedo? Perfect. Pants, all right.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. We hope there would be nothing there. Carson, thank you so much for the time and, good luck with the release. And then we hope everyone gets to go see the film either in theaters in a big city or streaming at some point soon. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
All right, welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we boot up the Good, Bad, Ugly, just a little news nugget. I mean, we have a bunch of other stuff. Padres signed Jose Iglesias, LOL, OMG. We had Justin Turner ripping the Seattle Mariners for not signing anybody. Good job. The dispute between the Orioles and the Nationals over their broadcasting situation with Masson was resolved. Cool. We got to talk about Vlad Jr., who opened yes. the books.
Well, to the degree that we did not understand before, right? When we talked about when Vlad Jr. gave the Blue Jays a deadline for when they could agree to an extension, which was the first full day of workouts in spring training, that passed. They didn't come to a deal. But when we were talking about it, we didn't really know what numbers we were really working with. And while we still don't know as of this recording exactly how high the Blue Jays were willing to go, based on this reporting and his conversation with Enrique Rojas of ESPN, it seems like we now have some details about what Vlad was looking for. Now, before I get to that, I want to go back to the conversation I had with Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet when we talked about the Vlad extension a couple months ago. And we were speculating, like, all right, what's it going to take? What do we think that Vlad's looking for? And I was like, just pay him, like, give him whatever he wants. Like, this is the guy you should build around. I made the case for it. I was like, if it's $500 million, like, I'd still do it if it was deferred. And I remember very specifically at the time, Ben was like, and Ben, if anybody's going to be plugged in with the Blue Jays thinking, it's going to be Mr. BNS, right? And he was like, I don't think it's going to take $500 million. Well, this is not a shot at Ben, who, if you're listening to the podcast, Ben, you know I love and appreciate you. It sounds like it absolutely would have taken more than $500 million, because based on this reporting, it sounds like Vlad Jr. was looking for not $600 million. I like how this was phrased as, you know, Vlad was offering sub $600 million offer, the premise being it was much less than Soto is what Vlad was saying. Like, I wasn't trying, everyone was saying, oh, well, he's trying to get what Soto got. It's like, no. I only wanted.
No, less I'm worse than him.
I'm worse than him, but I still want, you know, nearly $600 million. And it sounds like the Blue Jays were not willing to go that far. But this at least gives us a bit of a sense of like, okay, now we can look at it and be like, would I have given Vlad $580 million? Over 15 years. Me? Yeah, absolutely. Especially if we can get some deferrals worked in there. I'd do that so fast, especially because of what it means to the Blue Jays and kind of their future and how good I feel about them moving forward. Having him in place, even for this cost, I think would be worth it. But it seems like they were not willing to get there.
I don't know. Like, it's easy, and we do it all the time, to spend other people's money, right? Sure. And it's not as if the Blue Jays haven't invested or been willing to invest. Like, this ownership group has put a lot of money into this team, right? This is not a Seattle Mariners, Pittsburgh Pirates situation. And that is the type of contract, though, that can hamstring you if it goes wrong in very, very quickly. I think Vlad is great. I think he's a generational player. I think that number is inflated because of Soto, even though it's lower than Soto.
Absolutely.
Remember, we have not seen anything that high before Juan Soto. And I think that the Soto contract got as high as it did because the two New York teams were having a pissing contest. And so I don't think that Vlad is worth that number. Like, it sucks for Jays fans, right? And to be clear, like, Vlad has every right to go to the open market and see if he can get that number. And I think it's more likely that he goes to free agency and can get that number because he's pitting teams against one another, which is exactly what Soto did.
Yes. And this is, I think, my big takeaway here, as much as I'm still super bummed about how this has all transpired. And I wish that Vlad was a Jay for life. And like, that all makes me sad. But with that said, this is now a number, if we assume that it is something close to 600 million, all right, it was 575, whatever, that's the number we are now going to have in mind a year from now, that we know that he is shooting for at the bare minimum. And so we will find out if Vlad's sticking to it was a correct business decision. Now, he's going to end up getting, assuming he doesn't get injured or suddenly have a 100 OPS plus, like, he's going to get a lot of money regardless. I know the difference for most people between 500 and say, or 400 and $600 is whatever. But this now gives us a place where it's like, all right, that's how he views himself. And so now we know when he signs the contract next year, we'll be like, okay, he was right. Or the Jays were right to hold it and Vlad should have taken whatever his, or whatever should. I mean, again, he's going to be fine either way. But this is it. Now I feel like I have a better sense of, now that we know where he views himself. And so that will help inform the conversation a year from now. Now, how he does this year will also impact that. If he has another top three MVP finish, you could say, well, absolutely, he should get that, or he thinks he should get even more than that. But if he kind of stays where he is right now and has another very, very good season, I think it'll be interesting to have that number in mind as we talk about him as a free agent next winter. All right, Jake, let us get to the fun stuff. It's time. Of course, it's Friday. So let's do it. The good, the bad, the ugly. Something good, something bad, something Dan Ugla from the past week. A lot of Ugla candidates, a lot of good candidates, a lot of bad candidates. Why don't you start us off with something good?
I saw Paul Skeens pitch last night in person, and it was pretty cool, man. He's really good. The reigning 2024 Rookie of the Year and top three most famous baseball player already. Made his second
speed running his way to baseball fame. Yes.
Made his second spring training outing. He threw 3+ innings against the Orioles. The results, I don't particularly care. He was throwing really hard. And the experience of seeing Skeens throw in person is unlike any other pitcher in baseball. I wrote about it and for today on Yahoo about, I compared it to like watching a rhino do ballet. That a person that large can move in that way is just a remarkable thing. Now, what I'm very compelled by is the fact that he's adding two more pitches. He threw six different pitches last year, and he is now adding two more of them, a two-seam fastball and a cutter to his four-seamer, splinker, sweeper, slider, changeup, curveball mix. Good job, Jake. And I wrote about, does he need to do this? Why is he adding pitches, right? Shouldn't he just be leaning on the good stuff that people can't touch all the time? And I asked around about it and got kind of varying perspectives. Some people in baseball were like, he does not need to do this. Why is he doing this? There's too many cooks in the kitchen. Some people were like, well, Skeens' whole deal is about making the batter uncomfortable. And if you can just add more decisions into the brain, you're going to make it a more difficult experience for the hitter. Paul himself, when I asked him about it, more or less said, because I can.
Bingo. Yeah. Remember, the whole story, like one of the biggest parts of Paul Skeens becoming one of the best pitchers of baseball immediately is this splinker, sinker, whatever you want to call it, that he did not have in college. He added in pro ball and it was immediately one of the best pitchers in baseball. So if you feel like you can add pitches that can be that good immediately, he's like, yeah, I'm going to keep doing that. There's no rules against me having even more pitches. And if you're asking around the game who people are tasked with maybe beating Paul Skeens, they're like, yeah, no, it's fine. Please don't add any more pitches, Paul. We don't need you to do that.
But on the flip side, I talked to someone who was like, oh, you're telling me I don't have to see the fastball or the splinker as much? Like, great.
No, that's now, a valid, again, which is interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The cutter that he threw last night looked pretty good and will get a lot of outs just because he throws really hard and he's a really good pitcher. But if you want to dig into the why of it, I wrote about all of it. What he's trying to accomplish specifically with the two-seamer and the cutter I think is really interesting. So go give that a look. But anytime you get to watch Paul Skeens pitch, it is a good thing.
Especially when it wasn't broadcast and it wasn't on StatCast. So like you had the rare, it was like, whoa, like I'm seeing when not everyone gets to see this.
It felt kind like it was 1934. It was like,
it's a good,
the baseball game's for me.
which is a funny transition to my good, which is Chase Burns. Chase Burns, Reds first round pick from last year, yet to make his pro debut. He did not pitch after he signed last year, made his spring training debut earlier this week, and it was not broadcast, but we did have the Statcast data, and I have seen Chase Burns pitch on TV enough to know, and in person, by the way, I'm realizing. His stuff, this is it, related to Skeens, because Skeens is now up to whatever, 7-8 pitches, and oh my God. Chase Burns is rocking with two pitches right now. His fastball slider is so good. And in the way that, you know, we can talked about with Sasaki and how good can he be with just a fastball and a splitter, I don't think Chase Burns is going to start the year in the Reds rotation because, again, he hasn't thrown a real professional pitch yet. But this kind of stuff is going to get to the big leagues very quickly in some form or another. And so I don't know how that's really going to manifest, but I am very excited to see how quickly Chase Burns can overwhelm minor league hitters and force the Reds' hand into having him be in some sort of role this year, because the Reds do have a good amount of rotation depth right now, but I can imagine them being pretty tempted to add in Chase Burns sooner rather than later.
My bad is the Colorado Rockies tweeted out a AI slop picture of Nolan Jones making a catch. And
this seemed, yeah. Why did they do this?
Because I assume they did not have footage of the game. And so they thought it would be cute to be like, this is what probably what it looked like. And we've seen teams do this before where they draw it like with crayons. Like, that's kind of funny. But this is just so stupid and unnecessary and a weird use of AI. And like, the whole point of sports is that they are real. Like, they exist. And I just, this was so bad. It was very, you know, apocalyptic to me.
Yeah. Also, here's the really wildest part. They did have video of the catch. I don't know if it was broadcast, and I don't know if it's because everyone was flaming them, but like a couple hours after they posted this awful AI picture, they posted a video of Nolan Jones making the catch. So it's like,
also, no fans in the stands.
Right.
While making this catch.
I mean, whatever. There's, again, now you're giving too much credit, but yeah, it's apocalyptic. We don't like that. No AI, please. My bad this week, I guess, sort of also has to do with make-believe baseball. MLB The Show came out with their ratings. MLB The Show's coming out soon. Not a game we play that much, but it gives us some fun content sometimes. They released the ratings, the top five ratings for all 30 teams. They tweeted out, like, here are the top five rated players for every team. And why is that funny for certain teams? Because, what's this going to look like for the White Sox and Marlins and Rockies? Jake Mintz, would you like to guess who the highest rated players are for the White Sox and Marlins? Rockies were not Luis as Robert, interesting because they have some good players.
Yeah. Luis Robert Jr. and Sandy Alcantara.
That Luis Robert Jr. Is absolutely correct. And Sandy Alcantara is also actually not correct. Somehow he is rated below Yuri Perez, which is bizarre. But what is really upsetting to me is that among the top five rated Marlins is Griffin Conine, who played very briefly last year. Son of Jeff Conine, has big power, isn't very good at actually hitting, is very old for a guy who's maybe still prospect eligible. And Xavier Edwards was not in the top five. Actual good player, Xavier Edwards. That was disrespectful. And then the list of the top White Sox is just like truly tough to read. Here's the highest rated White Sox. Luis Robert, 77.
Good.
Mike Tauchman.
Okay.
So Mike Tauchman, Michael A. Taylor. Oh, Mike Clevenger, oh, at 73. Bryce Wilson. These are all veterans that they signed up one-year deals. And then Davis Martin, who's maybe something, okay. And then Penn Murphy, side-arming pitcher Penn Murphy, who's going to be like throwing the six for them if he's healthy, is somehow the second highest rated White Sox. Super weird, super funny, sort of ugla, but I have a different ugla. What's your ugla?
That's just such a bummer, man. Wow. Like, Mike Clevenger might not be on the opening day roster.
Yeah, let's hope not.
You might not make the team.
What's ugly for you?
Let's go to real estate corner. Jordan, if you wanted to sell a property that you owned, well, how would you go about that? I don't know how to do it. I've never owned property because it's expensive in America nowadays. But I'll tell you what, if I was Mets legend and broadcaster.
I did see this. sorry. Go ahead. Yep.
Keith Hernandez, Mets legend and broadcaster, tweeted out that he was selling his condo in Florida. Oh, no. I found it.
Yes.
My Florida condo is available for sale if anybody is interested. That's all he tweeted with the link. And I'm now opening the link.
Again, like, I guess this is the simplest way to do it. If you don't want to, like, sure. If I'm ever selling a house, I guess I could just post it to the barbecue account and see what happens.
If you got
a lot of followers, sure.
If you got 2.3 mil, you can buy it. Now, the funniest part of this, and I don't know this for a fact, this could be just a coincidence. The realtor listed is named Kai Hernandez.
Oh, okay.
Is that his daughter?
I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know anything about his family. But I do know that this does not surprise me based on Keith Hernandez's social media presence, for better or for worse. I'm not surprised he's just posting through it. He's like, well, I'm not getting the offers I'm getting from whatever who I've hired to sell my house, so I'm just going to tweet it out.
It's his ex-wife.
Does she know that the house is being sold?
What?
All right, I don't want to get into the family affairs of Keith Hernandez, but
maybe they got back together. Funny. Whatever. I am fascinated by all of this. Goodbye.
So many questions, but anyway, it's there. You've got 2.3 million. I guess you can go buy his house. My ugly this week is Kevin Durant showing up to the White Sox Brewers spring training game. This is also good. Kevin Durant, Phoenix Sun, teammates with Ryan Dunn, a NBA rookie whose older brother Justin Dunn is a NRI pitcher with the Chicago White Sox, former first round pick, was with the Mariners, was with the Mets, has dealt with a lot of injuries over the last few years and is now trying to get back to the big leagues with the White Sox. And there's KD and Ryan Dunn just sitting in the front row in Maryvale, I believe. This was not at Camelback Ranch, as the White Sox were on the road facing the Brewers and Justin Dunn was pitching. But the reason this is ugly is Justin Dunn is like, yeah, no, like KD's been awesome to my brother. That's cool. He's a White Sox fan. He wears a White Sox hat every day. And, I'm trying to get him some stuff. And I was like, hold on a second. Is he a White Sox fan? And then I was like, he does wear a White Sox hat all the time. But I do need to know more about Kevin Durant and the White Sox connection. Because I'm not telling Justin Dunn that he's wrong. Like, he clearly knows Kevin Durant. So yeah. Maybe he has told him, like, I'm a White Sox fan. I just want to know more about what that means. Because I have seen him wear a White Sox hat often. And I need to know more about that, because I would love how he feels about the direction of this franchise. And, does he believe in Chris Getz and this new infrastructure to kind of get this team back on track after one of the worst seasons in baseball history?
Great question, Jordan.
So I don't know. I guess we'll have to ask next time we see Kevin Durant. I know you're shook about the Hernandez family dynamic.
I'm still drowning in this. Yeah. Like,
okay.
Are they back together? Is his ex-wife selling his apartment? If so, that's great. Like,
that
seems healthy.
Anyway,
let's get out of here.
That's it. We're done. Thank you to Carson Lund for joining us, talking us about the film Ephes. Thank you to Carter Singh for producing this episode of Baseball Barbacast. You can email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. Next week, division previews begin. NL East on Monday, folks. We got more Marlins chat coming. Don't you worry. All right. You think I gave Xavier Edwards his flowers here? It's coming even harder next week. Just you wait. And yeah, we'll probably talk about the Mets and Phillies and Braves too. And Nats. Sorry to my brother David. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you next week.